Joseph Stalin, Marshal of the Soviet Union, died in 1953, and his death was followed by a brief power struggle amongst his colleagues, a struggle from which Nikita Khrushchev emerged supreme. Khrushchev held the reins of power in the Soviet Union from 1953 until 1964, and on April the 15th of that year, he reached his 70th birthday, and the occasion was celebrated both inside and outside the Soviet Empire. Congratulations from around the country and the whole world filled the airwaves. Newspapers and magazines hailed the great decade since Khrushchev had taken office, and for his many achievements, he was awarded the grand title of Hero of the Soviet Union. And what's more, early on the morning of his birthday, security men lugged a large radio TV console into his living room, which in those days was the last word in luxury. And it bore a metal plate with the inscription, "From your comrades in the Central Committee and the Council of Ministers." And guests began to arrive at 9 o'clock. Relatives, presidium members, secretaries of the Central Committee, and all the rest of the day was to be devoted to public celebrations, but at the beginning it was time for colleagues to sing Khrushchev's praises in private, which they duly did once their leader had appeared on the oak staircase, elegantly attired in a dark suit with medals all over his chest. And the adulation began with a fulsome tribute by his protégé, Leonid Brezhnev, no less. Brezhnev was his number two and the titular head of state. And Brezhnev said, "Dear Nikita Sergeyevich, we, your close comrades, extend special greetings and fervently congratulate you, our closest personal friend and comrade, on your 70th birthday." And brushing away tears, Brezhnev hugged Khrushchev and presented him with a handsome case containing a copy of the speech that he had just read, which had been signed by all the guests. And through the day, congratulations continued to pour in, finishing with a grand reception at an evening banquet in the Kremlin. And that all happened on April the 15th, 1964. 6 months later, while Khrushchev was on holiday in the south, it was the very same Brezhnev who led the coup that ousted him. He denounced Khrushchev to his erstwhile colleagues. He charged him with one failing after another. And he installed himself comfortably in Khrushchev's place, where he remained until his death in 1982. And that treacherous behavior at the top and the abrupt change of leadership in the Soviet Union sent shockwaves around the world. It had a major impact on the course of future world events. This morning we come again to John chapter 13, to a very different scene. Here, no crowds, no adulation, no TV console, certainly, no banquet, no gifts, no palace, no grandeur. Instead, just a simple upper room in a house in Jerusalem, where Jesus has gathered with his friends for a final meal together. Few people would have known about or reported on what was going on, but what happens at and shortly after this meal has had a far greater impact across the world and down the centuries than that headline-grabbing replacement of one Soviet leader by another. And it has personal implications for us too, for you and me, as we watch the unfolding events and find that we, in a very real sense, are ourselves involved. We are here in the upper room. And we are involved in what goes on. We are addressed and we are compelled to consider where we stand ourselves in relation to the central figure. The 12 disciples are present with Jesus. Watching them, we see treachery and confusion. Watching Jesus, we see authority and love. So let's consider each of those in turn. First, treachery. Treachery at any level is a horrible business, isn't it? Perhaps you have a memory of it from school days. Maybe there was someone who you thought was a good friend and he or she turned against you and sided with others whose approval meant more to them than your friendship, and you were strangely alone. Or maybe it's more recently in a working world where an apparently loyal and trusted colleague turned out to be nothing of the kind. Treachery is hard at any level. Hardest of all, perhaps, is the sense of betrayal that results from marital infidelity. And that was the experience of Jennifer Crowley. Jennifer Crowley was a Christian woman, married to a Christian man for 22 years. And she writes in a very moving memoir about the impact on their family life when her husband suddenly left her for another woman. And it was, she says, the shock of finding that the one she had known as her closest friend had suddenly become her enemy. Well, betrayal and the thought of betrayal had had its place amongst the many Old Testament predictions about the coming of the Messiah. The Psalms, for instance, and the writings of the prophets contain many clues as to what this Messiah, when he comes, will be like, how he will live and speak and behave, and indeed how he will be treated by his contemporaries. And in verse 19 of our passage today, words from Psalm 41 are found on the lips of Jesus. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. We talked, don't we, being kicked in the teeth by somebody's actions. And that's really the thought here, I think. Lifting the heel, much as a horse might be provoked into lashing out with its hoof. The difference being that there has been no justification in this case, no provocation at all. The one doing the kicking has eaten the bread of the one being kicked. He who ate of my bread has lifted his heel. And Middle Eastern hospitality, of course, is hugely highly prized. So it is really the last word in the abuse of friendship to sit at someone's table and enjoy their hospitality and then turn and attack them. Which, says Jesus, is exactly what Judas is about to do. Someone who works in the villages outside Cambridge reports that when sheep are taken off to be killed, they know instinctively that the slaughterhouse is a bad place. They can smell or sense something which warns them of danger. The lorry carrying them will stop and the gangplank will be put down, but the sheep will refuse to move. And the slaughterhouse operators have devised a way of getting around the problem. They keep a sheep on the premises permanently, which is used to the place and so doesn't mind it anymore. They take that sheep up the plank onto the lorry, and then it walks down again quite happily. And the other sheep, seeing one of their own leading the way, follow. And the slaughterhouse workers call this sheep Judas, because the name of Judas is synonymous with treachery today, and various ingenious attempts have been made to excuse him, to portray him in a better light, to justify his treachery. But of course, Jesus does not see him in that way at all. He says in Matthew's account, it would have been better for that man if he had never, ever been born, never come into the world, than behave like that. And there's an alarming progression in Judas's downward slide into darkness and into the night. At the beginning of the chapter in verse 2, we learnt last time that the devil had already suggested to Judas the idea of betraying their master. But Judas didn't need to give the idea any room. He chooses freely to do what he does. He's no puppet. He could and should have kicked out the thought as soon as it came in. But that sequence of events, that downward slide, is common to all experience of temptation. And it's why we had James chapter 1 that Ruth read for us earlier on. It's what James describes, the downward slide. Each person, says James, is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Can't blame anybody else. And then desire, when it has conceived, says James, gives birth to sin. Or in other words, when a wrong desire receives the assent of the will, when the desire is welcomed rather than expelled, it results in sin. And sin, of course, never stands still. And when it is fully grown, says James, the end result is death. So the devil puts the thought into his heart, but Judas makes room for it. And by verse 27 of this passage, when Jesus has given Judas a morsel from the dish, it isn't just a thought that Judas entertains. We read that Satan himself has moved in as the guest and taken up residence in his heart. And that for Judas surely is the last stage in a process that's been underway for very much longer. A brick wall doesn't suddenly collapse for no reason. The weakness will have been there unseen all along. And so it is with this man. No one else other than Jesus has noticed it. And so the shock is all the greater when it comes. And it is a terrible thing, isn't it, when a person's conscience becomes so seared and so hardened that they resist every attempt to turn the back from a wrong path. And for 3 years, Judas could not have been closer to Jesus than he was. But by the end, he could not have been further away. And his end should be to us the starkest of warnings about what happens when someone's inner person and outward appearance finally part company. Because we read in verse 30 that after receiving the morsel of bread, Judas immediately went out, and, says John, it was night. Now that is one of John's masterstrokes as a storyteller. He immediately went out, and it was night. Not merely physical night, of course, but this man has gone out into the darkest of nights, and it's a night on which no morning will ever dawn. So there is treachery here, and it is extremely grim. If Judas shows us treachery, the other disciples are just confused. Just confused. So let's move from treachery to confusion. And it's obvious from the way John reports the events that the other 11 have really no idea what's going on at all. And this is obviously the record of somebody who was there at the time. It's full of little eyewitness touches. So in verse 22, we read, the disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom we spoke. We can picture that, can't we? Heads turning from side to side, and several of them frowning, one or two perhaps looking back at Jesus with raised eyebrows. And yet, out of respect for him, no one actually voices their puzzlement. I mean, he must mean what he says, but what is it that he means? And then Peter. It's always Peter, isn't it? Peter makes some kind of signal to the one reclining closest to Jesus. And they would have been reclining. This is not sitting around a table. Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting of the Last Supper completely misleads us in that they would have been reclining round a low U-shaped table. And they'd each have been leaning on their left arm and reaching for food with their right arm. It's not the way we do things, but actually for them it symbolized freedom and relaxation. In the original Passover, they had to leave in a hurry, in a rush. But the symbolic meal here represents freedom, and they recline and eat freely. So the disciple very close to Jesus will have leant back over his right shoulder at that point to Jesus, who's leaning behind him, and he will have met Jesus' eye very close. And he'll have asked him very quietly, in a whisper really, who do you mean? And Jesus very quietly answers, it is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it. He's the one who will betray. And the other disciples haven't heard what's said, and they remain confused. No one knows why he said this or what it was that he said. And their confusion highlights Judas's duplicity. He has played the part of a faithful follower for so long that nobody suspects him of anything at all. Until he comes back, of course, with soldiers and priests and weapons. So that's what we see in the 12. There's treachery in one and confusion in the remaining 11. But what about Jesus? What do we find when we look at him? Well, We find here what we find whenever we consider Jesus. And by the way, if you're new to us here, or if you're still unclear about Christian things, please do this with us. Do consider Jesus, because that's what it's all about. And in considering him, what do we find? We find the things we always find: twin marks of authority and love. And we think of authority at first. You call me teacher and Lord, he says in verse 13, and you are right, for that is what I am. That's a fairly mind-blowing thing to say about yourself, isn't it? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right. That is what I am. In other words, whatever the Quran may say, with respect to our Muslim friends, he is much more than a prophet, and he's more even than the greatest of the prophets. And he is plainly in control in this scene. Some people have a kind of natural authority, don't they? If you're in the room with them and others are there too, it's not long before everyone is aware of who the key player is in the room. I know people like that. I expect you do too. And it's certainly the case here. So in verse 18, for instance, he talks about people he has chosen. What does he mean by saying in verse 18, I know whom I have chosen? What does he mean by that? It's not immediately clear. He could possibly mean, I've chosen 11 of you, and I do know you 11, but of course I haven't chosen Judas. He's not one of the chosen. And the first half of the verse might lend weight to that, where he says, I'm not speaking about all of you. So it could mean, I know you 11, but of course I don't know him. But it's more likely that by comparison with earlier words about Jesus, about Judas, that he's spoken back to chapter 6, that all 12 disciples are in mind as he talks about the chosen. Judas included. And when Jesus knows them, it means that no one is pulling the wool over his eyes. The disciples may be confused and a bit later shocked by Judas's treachery. But Jesus is neither confused nor shocked, either then or later on. He always knew what was in people, says John earlier on. And of course, he still does know what is in people. And the disciples, looking back later on, will be able to see that he knew what he was doing all along, that he hadn't blundered by including Judas in the 12 and in the chosen. I sometimes look back over the way life has gone and decisions I've taken, whether in personal life or family life or church life or whatever, and I think, if I could go back and rewrite that one, I think I would. And that's normal enough, isn't it? The wisdom of hindsight, we all know it. Jesus never needed the wisdom of hindsight. He acted as he spoke with authority and wisdom. And he never had any reason to revisit anything that he had ever said or done. He was a real human being, a real man, subject to all the temptations and strains that come across your path and mine. And the Bible is very clear about that. And yet he was different, quite unlike you and me. So see the authority with which he directs even these disturbing events in the upper room. And do note that this authoritative teacher submits himself unswervingly to another authority, which is the authority of Scripture, of the Old Testament. It's because he knows the Old Testament and understands it so well and sees in it the plan of God for his own life that he's not fazed by the reality of sin in the world. He never has to handle sin in himself, but there's no shortage of it all around him, in his friends as well as in his foes. So how is it that he can contemplate Judas's action with such a calm and unruffled spirit? It's remarkable. And how is it? Well, it's because it's written in Psalm 41. He who has eaten my bread has lifted his heel against me. And King David wrote that centuries before. But Jesus knows that it has to be fulfilled right here at this meal in the upper room. And he retains his authority even when Satan has entered into the betrayer. He says to him at that point, what you're going to do, do quickly, and it's a word of authority. And Judas the betrayer is instantly obedient to the word of Jesus. Jesus tells him to do quickly what he's going to do, and he immediately goes out into the night. He is in control from beginning to end. Now, last Sunday, we watched Jesus washing the feet of his disciples, taking the role of the humblest of servants, bending low to serve them. Here we see him having resumed his seat and absolutely in control. If he is a servant, it's because he chooses to be. He is both teacher and Lord. He is Lord of all and servant of all. So his authority is here, and his authority is intertwined with his love. And of course, that too we must consider, because love is the main feature of it, which is so wonderfully evident in this scene. The main feature, the whole narrative is saturated with love. There's love for his much-loved disciple in particular. There's one who is singled out. He's referred to in verse 23 as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Doesn't mean he didn't love the rest of them, but there does seem to have been a special place in Jesus' heart for this man, who is generally taken to be the Apostle John. Jesus has, as we would say, a soft spot for him. And the others are not in any way resentful of this. Clearly, it's like a favoritism. It may well be that John, if it was John, was just a lad and just a teenager at the time, and they all looked on him that way. And Jesus loves this young man, but he loves them all, and it's because of his tender concern for all of them that he tells them now what is going to happen, that one of them will betray him. And he explains to them that it's all part of God the Father's plan. Verse 19, we read, I'm telling you this now, before it takes place, so that when it does take place, you may believe that I'm he. In other words, you won't be taken aback and knocked for six. You will believe and go on believing. You won't give up and run away. And though they do, of course, run away at the time of his arrest, they still stick together after his crucifixion. They are mostly together when the risen Jesus appears. He has cared for them and warned them ahead of the time, thereby reducing something at least of the shock of the betrayal. So he loves the individual, he loves the 11, and included in the 11, of course, is Judas. And Jesus acts in love to Judas. John says in verse 21 that after saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit. And we may wonder why. Partly, at least, it's because he loves this man. He has befriended him and taught him and shared his life with him for 3 full years. And everything he has given to Judas is about to be thrown away, thrown back in his face, really, kicked back by that lifted heel. It's desperately sad. And Jesus feels it and is troubled in his spirit. And in our day, few things can be sadder than seeing someone come close to Jesus Christ, maybe over an extended time, maybe even getting very close to faith in him, only to turn away at the last minute. It does happen. In fact, it happens too often. But then just once would be too often. And if it saddens us, it must sadden the Son of God infinitely more. And I guess that's the flip side, isn't it, to the joy that reverberates throughout heaven, according to Jesus, when just one sinner, just one, repents and turns and believes. Jesus loves this man, and it troubles him deeply that he's going to lose him in this way. Now, at times earlier in his public life, when Jesus has encountered sin in the world, he has been provoked into a very visible and very forceful, very public reaction, as at that time in the temple, for instance, when he makes a whip and drives the money changers out, denouncing them for turning the house of God into a den of thieves. He wasn't too meek and mild right then. And then his denunciations of the religious leaders and their hypocrisy are very fierce. Whitewashed tombs, he calls them, clean and shiny on the outside, but full of rottenness and corruption inside. Imagine how that went down. It's not exactly holding back, is it? Burning indignation is nearer the mark when confronted by this sin in the world. So why don't we find it here? There's no hint of it here in chapter 13. And this wickedness that he's confronted with is, if anything, greater than the others. Judas has enjoyed access to Jesus such as was never offered to the Pharisees and the money changers. So why now this restraint and this gentleness with the traitor? Well, surely it has to do with Judas's sin being personally directed at him. And though he will rise in hot anger when others are abused or the name of God is defiled, Jesus does not rise in his own defense. Instead, what he does is to reach out to the offender with a final gesture of love. He dips a morsel into the shared dish and he holds it out to Judas, which was a mark. It was a way of showing very special friendship. And their eyes will have met at that point, surely. And the unspoken message was this: I offer you, even now, my friendship, even as I offer you this portion of a shared meal. Even now, Judas, will you not turn and stay with me? It's so different, isn't it, from a sort of police identity parade. He is identifying Jesus, as he says to John. He is identifying Judas, as he says to John, it is the man to whom I will give this morsel. But in an identity parade at the police station, if one of the 10 is identified as the criminal, no love is lost either way between those involved, far from it. But in identifying Judas as the one, so that Judas knows that Jesus knows, in doing that, he makes him a last and a final offer of what has been there all along. There is great authority and there is extraordinary love here. Do you recognize that authority today of Jesus? It hasn't changed. And what is your response to his love? We are involved in this. It doesn't matter which point you break into the story of Jesus, whether it's in the somewhat easier early days when he gathers his disciples and begins to preach and teach and go about doing good, or whether it's later on as the clouds begin to gather and people turn away and his friends leave him to his fate. Wherever you intersect with the narrative, you find these twin things of the authority and the love of this central figure. And it is a love that extends to you and me today, because verse 20 is about us. It's about our encounter with Jesus and our knowledge of him. Do look with me at verse 20, where Jesus, looking down history at this point, says, truly, truly, in other words, this is tremendously important, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send, the messenger with the gospel, receives me. And whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. What is the most valuable gift we could ever receive? It's the gift of eternal life, which is found in knowing him, the one true God, and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent. That's the most precious gift we could receive. It's what we were made for. Nothing in the world can compare with it. Whoever receives me, says Jesus, receives the one who sent me. Nothing can compare with that. So let no one among us think otherwise.